Okay, good morning everyone, and welcome back to day three of the ICANN Summer School. I'd just like to welcome all of the folks from the Neuroimaging Training Program, the NITP, that's run by Ross Holdrack and Mark Cohen. Those of you who weren't here on the first day, there's been a tremendous interest in brain imaging this summer. And when we first planned this summer school with Mark Green at ICANN, Ross and Mark were also having a training program where there was hands-on experience with software for neuroimaging and experimental design. So what we've decided to do for this morning and tomorrow morning is have the NITP folks, about 35 of them, I think, join us for the morning lectures. And it looks like it's worked out okay. I'm a little nervous that we wouldn't have enough room, but it looks like we're just right. Also, the speakers have very generously agreed to be recorded, so they'll be streaming video. I think not in real time, but the talks will be all on the internet if you'd like to hear them in your leisure later on. Just one announcement. We're very happy that there's been a good response to the student presentation. So tomorrow afternoon, there'll be 10 student talks from those of you in the audience today. Each around 10 minutes, if you keep to maybe 5 or 6 slides, that should be fine. Just for logistics, if you'd like to try and present from your own laptop, you're very welcome to plug that in during today during a break or tomorrow during a break, just to make sure that things are as you wish. That'll be at the revised time of 4 o'clock. And so the program for tomorrow is slightly changed. One of our speakers, Monica Hurdle, who couldn't make her flight on Monday, is in the schedule now at 4 o'clock, at 3 o'clock tomorrow, so that the student talks are at 4. Before I introduce Christophe, just a note about today. So the fusion tensor imaging is the topic of today's 6 lectures, and it's really just experienced this phenomenal growth in interest in the last few years, partly because the mathematics are very, very deep and rich. These are images that are inherently tensor valued, or if you analyze them more deeply, there's even more complex geometry underlying them. So very special mathematics is required for even registering the images, segmenting them, determining connectivity, doing statistics on tensors or higher-order objects to represent the diffusion process. So one of the exciting things is that we've really brought together 6 of the most famous DTI people in the world to introduce this, really from a relatively rudimentary level. So those of you who are applied mathematicians, you'll see a great deal of work this afternoon that will really stretch the limit of mathematical creativity. And also this morning, the neuroscientists who are interested in really just learning what DTI is and what the signals mean and how to analyze them from a fundamental level, will be tutorial explanations as well. So anyway, Christophe Langley is at Siemens Research Corporation. I've worked with Christophe a little bit for the last year, and we published a few papers together, and he's a thoroughly great guy. I was going to tease him because he ran the half Ironman triathlon this Sunday. And so those of you familiar with long-distance running and swimming and cycling, this is Christophe's 4th event of the week. It's giving a mathematical lecture. And also, Christophe's done a great deal of reinventive work in denoising, registering, and segmenting DTI. So he's agreed to give an overview of the concepts involved in processing DTI in the high angular resolution analog of Hardy. So thanks, Christophe.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, Paul. Thanks for inviting me here today. I need to stop that thing before. All right. So, as Paul said, I'm going to try to give an overview of what is DTI, so from the signal up to the actual application, so tractography and application of tractography to looking at the cortical striatal circuit, so trying to use DTI and fMRI to look at anatomical and functional connection in the brain. And then I will try to show you some application also of segmentation, both for DTI and Hardy data. And at the end, I will also describe a little bit of something that has already been presented on Monday by Guillermo Shapiro about using manifold learning techniques to look at the complexity, the non-uniform complexity of the brain using Hardy data. So just 2 slides about what we are actually looking at with diffusion MRI, which is essentially the brain white matter.
So which is, as you pretty much, I guess, all know, composed of axonal nerve fibers, and they are found in different regions of the brain, the inner layer of the cortex, the optic nerves, and the spinal cord, for instance. And they can basically be either very diffusely distributed or concentrated into bundles of three main types: the projection tract, like connection between the cerebral cortex and the subcortical areas, association tracts, long distance connection between the cortical regions, or commissural tracts, like the corpus callosum, for instance. And here is an example of such connections. Here is an example of a dissection of the brain, and on the right you can see a picture showing the different kind of bundles, like short arcuate fibers, the superlongitudinal fasciculus, or the axonal capsule, which are kind of famous fiber bundles that people have been looking at when doing DTI and especially tractography. So that's what we're looking at. How do we look at it using diffusion MRI, and what are the different models that we can derive from diffusion MRI? And I will concentrate on DTI, diffusion tensor, and on QBI, cubal imaging, which are two particular cases of diffusion MRI. So the very beginning of the story is the anisotropic diffusion of water molecule anywhere, but especially in the brain for us. So if you look here on the left, you have four particles starting from a point R0 and moving in a given in randomly under Brownian motion. And if you look at in an isotropic sample, the diffusion coefficient is just this scatter value here, where R is the motion of water molecule. But if you look at it in an anisotropic sample, then water molecules are constrained by the medium, and they actually move more along the direction of the bundles, and then you have to use a higher order model to look at the properties of the motion of the water molecule, and this is the so-called diffusion tensor. And that gives you information. If you actually do some computation on that, you can infer some scalar values that give you information about the macrostructure, the orientation, and the integrity of the brain. So in the brain, what is the origin of the water the anisotropic diffusion of water molecule? Well, it turns out that it's mostly the presence of the axonal membrane and the myelination of the axons that modulates it. As you can see here, the structure, the neurofibrillates, do not affect it. That was shown by Mosley in 91. It's actually 91. And the ratio of the diffusion along the bundle and across it is about 2 to 4 for a diffusion time of about 30 milliseconds. So that's the origin of the signal, and how do we measure it? So I'm going to spend quite a few slides on the diffusion signal. What is it, and how from these, this is the basic equation from Steschkell and Tanner that says that the signal in a given direction, K is just an index to say, okay, we're going to be looking at n directions for a diffusion time tau, is given by this. And as you can see, just the Fourier transform of P. P is the probability density function, the PDF, the density of the motion of water molecule. And that's what everybody would like to have. It's called the ensemble average propagator, P, so the probability of having a given motion for water molecule given starting point and a diffusion time. So this is, from this equation, the Fourier transform of P. So that's your signal. Q is, as I said, the direction in which we are looking at the diffusion. And I mean, JQ is the direction, and QK has to be thought of as a wave vector because we're in Fourier space. So that's the basic of the acquisition. Everything is done in Fourier space, and then we are going to reconstruct, hopefully, the EAP. But we can also make an assumption of Gaussian diffusion, and in that case, P is simply a Gaussian, like you can see here. So that was just to show you that if you vary the direction of acquisition, you have different contrasts appearing. So as I was saying, if you make the assumption of Gaussian diffusion, so you say that diffusion is Gaussian in every single direction, then you have this simplified version of the Steschkell-Tanner equation, which is a mono-exponential decay of the signal. So S0 is a T2 image, a regular unweighted diffusion image.
then D is going to be a diffusion tensor. JK is the direction you're looking at for a particular volume that you acquire. Delta is the time between the two gradient pulses in your sequence. Is basically the time you leave the water molecule to diffuse. And that's the very famous equation that everybody's been using to estimate tensors. And the tensors are 3x3 symmetric and positive definite matrices that gives you this covariance matrix of the water molecule. And you can estimate images like that, where you have at each voxel a small ellipsoid that depicts the covariance matrix. And from that, you can also infer scalar value images like the ADC, which is the trace of the tensor, different anisotropy measure, linear, FA, planar, spherical, or the major eigenvector, which gives you information about the direction, the major direction of diffusion. And it's been applied to a lot of cerebrovascular, like cerebrovascular disease, multiple sclerosis, different kind of neurological disorders. However, there are limitations to the diffusion tensor model. Namely, it is unable to resolve fiber crossing, where you have here in this phantom created by Jennifer Campbell at McGill, you can see that if you start from either point here, once you reach the crossing area, the tracking, which is a streamline-based fiber tracking, stops because the FA just drops because of the tensor model. Also, if you go in this region with high curvature, it's hard to get it because of the high curvature. So to try to address this problem, people have derived other acquisition schemes. And the basic idea is to sample the Q space. So this QK vector I was talking about before, this wave vector in Fourier space, is actually what you want to use to sample at each voxel of your volume a 3D grid. So a 3D Cartesian grid in Q space is sample, and then if you just apply a 3D inverse Fourier transform by the very definition of the signal SQ, you can recover P, so the sample average propagator. So that's what you can see here, where you have examples of diffusion-weighted images, and this is the grid. So 515 points have been acquired at each single voxel of your volume. So as you can imagine, this is pretty demanding in terms of times, and so we have long imaging times. It requires large B values because you have to vary the B values. You have to vary the length, the magnitude of this Q wave vector, and it requires many measurements. And it turns out that for tractography, all we actually need is the angular information of this 3D function. So in the end, what we do is we take the radial integral of the 3D AP, so which is defined by this, so the integral over U, which is a unit vector for a given direction, you're going to integrate your 3D function, and that's what you see here. So in 2D, if you have a 3D value, a full 2D function here, you take these two axes and you're just integrating along each of them. So the profile you can see here you have a lot of values with high, you have a lot of points with high values here. So when you're going to integrate it, you're going to have a high value, so a high probability of diffusion in this direction, but here you're going to have a low probability of diffusion. So this is what I'm showing here. So if you have a fiber diffusion like that, the diffusion profile looks like this. Of course, the diffusion tensor looks like that because it's just very limited in terms of angular information. But the ODF, what's called the orientation distribution function, the radial integral of the EAP looks like that. So you can get peaks and you can get information about the multiple fiber compartments. So this was diffusion spectrum imaging. So this is really great because you can access the full 3D information of the EAP, but as I said, we only need really the orientation information. So what people like essentially David Tuck have been working on is cubal imaging, which is a way to directly recover only the angular information of the fiber distribution. And this is achieved by just sampling a single sphere in Q space. So instead of sampling the full 3D space, the full 3D Fourier space, you just choose a given wave vector Q, and you acquire data on this shell. So instead of that, you get that. So you have a lot less points, and you only have points on the sphere. So what I'm going to try to do now is to show you that. Let me just
reformulate the notion of the integral, the radial integral, so the psi u, so the ODF, the angular information of the EFP is defined as that, as I said already. If you rewrite it in using cylindrical coordinate system and you just choose u to be the z-axis, you don't lose anything doing that. You can rewrite it like that, and since this is the integral along the z-axis, you can also rewrite it using a delta function like that. So that's basically the integral of your signal along the z-axis. What David Tuck has shown is that this guy here, which is called the Funk radiant transform of the signal on the sphere, actually approximate this ODF. So what you can do is simply from the signal, this signal acquired in the sphere, compute the Funk radiant transform and of the signal, and this is going to approximate psi of u. So that's what I'm going to try to prove, at least to give you an intuition of why this is true. The definition of the Funk radiant transform is that for a given point on the sphere, the value is going to be the integral along the equator of the signal. So as you can see here. So to give you an intuition, this is what it's done. So if you want to evaluate the value at this point here, you're going to integrate along that equator, which is all the red points. So you're going to have a high value here. Here you have two peaks, so the value in this direction here is going to be also very high because you integrate in this direction and then in this direction. So that's the definition of the Funk radiant transform. So if we rewrite it like here, so the Funk radiant transform in the q prime direction, in the direction u, so which is z here, is simply the integral over the great circle in the xy plane. So this is what is written here. And you can also rewrite it like that, where we use the delta function. And it turns out that using the pretty well-known Parseval Plantarol theorem that says that the integral of the product of two functions is actually equal to the integral of the product of the Fourier transform of those functions, you can rewrite this guy like that. So you have the 2D Fourier transform of your signal, the Fourier 2D transform of your delta function here, and we just need to evaluate these two guys, and hopefully it will be equivalent to that expression here, which is what I'm going to show in the next slide, the next one actually. So to be able to derive these two, this red and blue guy, all you need is the central slice theorem and the Hankel transform. The central slice theorem just say that the 2D Fourier transform of the projection of a function on a plane defined by a vector u is equal to the intersection of the 3D Fourier transform of a function defined by also this plane u. So by the intersection with a plane u. So that's the two definitions of the transform L and I. So and the Hankel transform is just a special case of the Fourier transform with no angular dependency. So the Fourier transform of a 2D function, which is only dependent on the radius r, is actually expressed by like that. So using these two theorem, we can rewrite these two guys. So the Fourier transform of the signal is just using that expression, the 2D Fourier transform of the intersection of the 3D Fourier transform of p, where the intersection is defined by the plane with which we take the intersection is defined by the vector u, and by definition this is just, if you just apply the Fourier transform here, this is L of p of r theta z. So that's the integral of the EAP. The other guy here is simply the application of this transform, where at the end you see that you have the integral of the delta at location q prime, so that's just this guy here, and J0 is the zeroth order Bessel function. So at the end, if you put everything together, the Funk radiant transform is given by this expression here. So you just plug the blue and red guy into the previous integral and you get that. And if we recall the very definition of the ODF, which was that, you can see that it's pretty much the same thing. The only difference being that the delta function here is approximated by the zeroth order Bessel function. So what does that mean? It means that if you have
a very low value for Q, which is again the equivalent of the B value. So when you do a diffusion tensor, you have to choose this B value. Typically, it's 1,000. If you have very low value for that, you're going to have a very wide Bessel function. So you're going to smooth. You're going to really smooth this this function here. So you're going to have a rough approximation of the ODF. On the other side, if you take large Q value, you're going to have a Bessel function that looks like a Dirac, so you're going to have a very nice approximation of the ODF, and that's why people are trying to have high B values to do our cuboid imaging. So that's what it looks like. So that's just a section around the intersection of the corpus callosum and the corticospinal tract, where you can see that you have these nice functions with multiple peaks that gives you information about the different bundles crossing in this area. So that was the signal and the origin of the local diffusion models, tensors, ODFs. To be able to process them and actually to compute them, to estimate them, we need some mathematical tools. And I'm going to describe a little bit of I'm going to give a little bit of details about this, the space of symmetric and positive definite matrices, and just one slide about spherical harmonics to have some tools to understand how the ODFs are actually computed from the signal. Just one slide about Riemannian geometry, because it's really at the core of the space of symmetric and definite positive matrices. So a Riemannian manifold is simply something that locally looks like Rn, so an n-dimensional Riemannian manifold locally looks like Rn. It is equipped with a collection of inner product, so at each single point of the space, you have a different way to measure the length of a vector. Let's say V here is going to have a length here, which is going to be different than the length here if you Rn transport it. So that's what I was saying. The magnitude of the tangent vector depends on the tangent space it is attached to, so it depends on the metric, and it's given by this quadratic form. And once you have a way to measure the magnitude of a tangent vector, you can also compute distance between different points. So if you have sigma 1 and sigma 2, you can integrate along the curve. I don't know if you can see the curve here. There is a blue curve that links sigma 1 and sigma 2. You can integrate the norm of the velocity of the geodesic, which is the tangent of the geodesic at each single point, and it gives you the distance, the geodesic distance between these two points. So once you have a notion of distance, you can do statistics on Riemannian manifold, and we're just going to talk about mean and covariance metrics here. So the mean is simply the minimizer of the variance. So if you have a set of tensors, the variance is defined obviously by that, so that's the sum of the square distances between each point and the mean. And the empirical covariance matrix is given by that, where phi here is simply a function that takes a symmetric matrix, which is a three by three matrix, into a vector form, so a vector of R6. And it gives you at the end a 6 by 6 matrix. So, and the beta i here are just the tangent at the mean of the geodesic linking the mean to each point. So sigma 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And they are given by this expression. So the gradient of the distance from the mean to the point of interest. So for the Gaussian case, for the manifold of Gaussian distribution, it turns out that those functions are parameterized by these 6 independent components, so the 6 components of the covariance matrix. And so they form a submanifold of R6, which is noted as +3. And this matrix, this submanifold looks like that. So locally, the tangent space of the manifold is S3, which is a space of symmetric matrices. So the tangent vector in that case is going to be a symmetric matrix, and each point is symmetric and positive definite. That's the covariance matrices. And it locally maps into R6, because those are the 6 independent components of the tensors. But there are many metrics that we can use, the J-divergence, the Riemannian metric, and what people have been looking at, and we applied that actually to the segmentation problem, is what are the different behaviors of the statistics
when you use different distances between tensors. So, of course, the Euclidean distance is pretty much trivial. The J divergence has been used, for instance, by Wang et al. To do segmentation also. The distance is given by the symmetrized, where we should have parentheses here, that's the symmetrized Kullback-Leibler divergence. The Kullback-Leibler divergence is given by that. It turns out that it's invariant by a congruence transformation, and it's actually very nice because for 3D Gaussian function, you have a closed form expression for the distance between these two guys, between these two symmetric positive definite matrices. And the tangent, so the gradient of the square distance, so the tangent at a given point to the geodesic, is also given by this closed form expression, which is very nice because we could not only compute the mean, but also compute the covariance matrix in a very efficient manner.
Christoph?
Yes. Yes.
But it doesn't satisfy triangle inequality, right?
No. Yeah.
So
that's why we call it just divergence. Yeah, it's not a distance.
No, well, I'm not questioning what you call it, but the distance. So
yeah.
If you use it as a distance, it's not really.
It's not really.
You can't really define open sets and do the real program that we have with metrics.
That is true.
So
that is correct.
What would that mean in this setting? You know, what does that really mean if we use it as a distance when we can't really, you know?
No. I get you. That's
do,
what does that mean? Yeah.
What does it mean for the whole formula? I mean, you're in the middle of this formulation, so you understand. What would we lose by being able to go through alternative cities along the way and not have a longer path?
Right. Yeah. Probably we need to look at the. For instance, if you compute the mean tensor, what is the properties like the anisotropy of this mean tensor? Are they biased because we use that? In terms of, you know, the properties of the microstructure, if you compare it to the Riemannian or not the Euclidean, of course, but the Riemannian one, probably you may have artifacts because of the fact that it does not satisfy.
You guys, yourselves, and the French group, I mean, it's a big group.
Yeah.
You guys use things from Kullback, the original Kullback, actually.
Right. Yes, to do the segmentation, we compared it. I'm going to show some results about it. And it turns out that the Riemannian metric does a better job, as it is expected, so probably because of that, in terms of, you know, the way you compute the mean and the covariance matrix, because of the fact that it's not a distance.
But that's sort of hypothetical. I mean, you don't have an actual experience where you see the loss of triangle inequality manifesting in the setting.
I don't have a very specific example where we can say this is because of that, but that's really true. You're right. Yeah. So the Riemannian metric is just is computed from the Fischer information matrix, which is a way to measure the amount of information carried by random variables. So it's usually used in statistical inference where you have measurements and you want to find the best parameters of the densities that describe those measurements. Here it's a little bit different. We already have those parameters, and all we want to do is simply compare the covariance matrices. So it's a little bit different setting, but the application is the same. This metric gives you the Riemannian metric, and turns out that for Gaussian distance, the Gaussian densities, it looks like that. So if you apply it to the interpolation problem, for instance, you have very different behavior between the Euclidean metric and the Riemannian metric, where you can see that the Carter here, which is DFA, evolve much more smoothly here than here, where you use the Euclidean metric. So it's much more linear. And those are just to show that we also have closed form solution for the geodesics, the solution of this equation here, which is really nice. I'm going to use that in the next slide to do a gradient descent in that space to estimate the tensors. And the distance is also given by this expression. That just to say that we can apply the previous slides for statistics on Riemannian manifold with those particular example of distance given the geodesic, the Riemannian metric, and the beta I looks like that. The geodesic gradient descent simply use the expression of the geodesic, so it looks like that, and the covariance matrix is again given by this expression. And there has been an alternative framework derived recently by Vincent Orsini and people at INRIA,
which is called a log Euclidean framework, which is very efficient because we can do computation. It turns out that taking the log of those matrices, you can do computation in Euclidean space and then come back with using the exponential, matrix exponential. So this is more efficient in terms of computational time.
Are you saying that they are equivalent?
They're not.
Okay.
No. But they are very, very, very close in practice. One last slide about the tools, namely the spherical harmonics, because this is what we really need for the processing of the ODFs, so the spherical functions. So that's pretty much known. They form a basis for complex functions in the sphere. They are the equivalent. I mean, the spherical harmonic transform is the equivalent of the Fourier transform on the sphere. Even other spherical harmonics are antipodally symmetric, so it's very nice because in our case the diffusion is symmetric. So it turns out that we can derive a modified spherical harmonic basis to do computation on RDFs that enforces the symmetry, and we can also enforce the fact that the function is real. That's pretty easy, and they satisfy the angular part of the Laplace equation, which is given by that. And this is pretty nice also because it gives you an expression for the Laplace-Beltrami operator of spherical harmonics, which is just that guy here. L is the order of the spherical harmonics, and M is its degree, as you can see here. So when you vary L and M, you have different shapes appearing for the sphere on a function. So at 0, 0 is basically the isotropic function, so just the sphere. So that's very useful, actually, when you want to enforce some smoothness on the estimation of the function on the sphere, because you can use the Laplacian on the sphere given by this expression. And to fit discrete data on the sphere, it's also very easy. You can just do it in a linear fashion by that. If X is your, let's say, your set of n values on the sphere, B is a matrix that you can pre-compute that is only given by the evaluation of spherical harmonics function, and C are the coefficient that you're looking for. You can compute them using the pseudo inverse like that, and that's very easy to do. Now that we have tools, I can talk about how we actually reconstruct the different models, so tensors and cubal. This is pretty much, I mean, this is very well known, so I'm going to probably skip that slide. That's just the regular tensor estimation using least squares. So we just linearize the Stechkal-Tanner equation, and you can rewrite it as a linear system like that and just invert the J matrix, which is here given by these guys here, and you can compute the components of your diffusion tensor like that. But it does not enforce the positivity of tensors, so you can have negative eigenvalues. So that's why we have proposed, among other people, there's a lot of methods to do that, to minimize this energy, which is a robust estimator of the linearized Stechkal-Tanner equation. So we can compute the gradient of this energy, which is given by that, Rk are the residual, that is what's inside this parenthesis. And you can do an interesting gradient descent using the geodesic equation that I just described on the space of symmetric positive definite matrices, using that gradient. So you just evolve along the geodesic in this direction to minimize this energy. And if you do that, you get, for instance, in the corpus callosum, this is the example that this is the result that you get if you do a regular least squares estimation, where you can have tensors that are actually degenerate, so you have negative eigenvalues. And if you do that, because it naturally enforces the fact that they have positive eigenvalues, of course they are very thin and very needle-like, but you get tensor with physically relevant values, physically relevant eigenvalues. Then for the computation of the diffusion ODF, it's actually pretty easy to do it because it's linear. You can prove that it's linear. So as I said, the estimation of the ODF by the Fanconian transform, which is the integral along an equator of the function, can be rewritten like that if you simply change SQ by a spherical harmonic expansion. And there is this Funk-Eco theorem that gives you a way to evaluate the integral on the sphere of a function, of the dot product of a function with
spherical harmonics in that way. I'm not going to describe it in more detail, but it turns out that if you rewrite this expression, where you can, by changing the delta function with delta sequence, because you cannot apply the previous theorem directly on this delta function, you can rewrite that guy here, so this integral right here, like that. And you can see that if you plug that into this expression, the Frank-Wedel transform turns out to be only a modification by this coefficient here of the spherical harmonic coefficients of the original signal. So all you have to do is simply linearly transform the spherical harmonic coefficients of your signal expansion on the spherical harmonic basis by this function, and it gives you an approximation of the Frank-Wedel transform, so it's linear. And as I said, because of the fact that the Laplace-Beltrami operator has such a simple expression, you can also enforce the smoothness of the results.
Quick question.
Sure.
In practice, what orders of spherical harmonics? What are the highest orders that you end up using?
8 usually. Usually 4, 6, and 8. Okay. Yeah. It's 15, 25, and I don't know how many coefficients, but it makes sense to go up to 8. Yeah. Okay, I think I'm going to have to cut some stuff. But anyway, so I want to show you one application of the tensors, so namely the tractography. This is a result that you can get if you follow the major eigenvector of tensors. What we've been looking at is how to actually try to use the whole information of the tensor field by computing a distance function and then computing, trying to approximate fibers as geodesics, as you can see on the right. The idea behind that is that you can use the tensor, the diffusion tensor, as a Riemannian metric. So you have to be careful here. This Riemannian metric gives you information about distances between voxels, so physical distance between voxels. It's not anymore distance between tensors. It's we're trying to approximate curves, 3D curves in the brain. And why this is true? Well, if you invert your tensor, like think of a very anisotropic tensor like that and another isotropic tensor like this. If you invert it, the magnitude of a given vector v is going to look like that, because you invert it, so you have 1 over 1 and 1 over 3, so that's the magnitude of v. But if it's isotropic, you have this magnitude. So the magnitude of the red vector here is actually smaller when you look at it with this anisotropic metric than if you look at it with this isotropic metric. So it means that if you have a very anisotropic diffusion at a given voxel, the geodesic distance, the physical geodesic distance between these voxels is shorter. So you have a short diffusion, and that's the path that is most likely to be followed by water molecules. That's what we say. It turns out that it works. So how do we compute the distance and the shortest path, and how do we evaluate them? I'm just going to give a little bit of detail about this formulation, because to compute the geodesic distance, you need to solve the Aeconal equation. It's a little bit tricky here, because it's not the classical Aeconal equation, it's an Aeconal equation with an anisotropic metric, so given by the tensor. Maybe I'm going to just fly through that and show you the result. It uses fast marching techniques. So that was just, I'm going to skip that. I'm just going to show you the result. The idea is that you can compute the distance in a very efficient manner, and at the end, you can recover the optimal path that corresponds to the shortest distance, as you can see here. So what we've done is that we've chosen this point here as the origin, computed the distance function from that everywhere in the brain, and then we can compute the shortest path from every single point in the brain to that origin. And we can also compute a value that tells you if you are confident or not in every single path. And then you can threshold it. And what I showed before was the curve that only has very high confidence values. So that's a way to compute fibers using the tensors.
Is it a strong? I mean, there is a biological hypothesis here, in the sense that
yes.
The fiber cannot. I mean, they have no reason to be geodesic.
Why not? That's what I was saying. If you take your tensor, the point here is just the inversion of the tensor. So you say that you have a strong diffusion in a given direction, so the water molecule diffuse
a lot in this direction because it's aligned with the fiber bundles, then your distance, because inverted, is going to be very short. So looking at the shortest path.
But maybe in the short, for short.
Yeah, it's very local. It's true.
Locally, but if, I mean.
Then
there
we compute.
No chance. I mean, there would be chances to jump across fibers.
Would you mean?
I mean, going transverse, because if really you have to, I mean, if you really minimize the distances, the geodesic distances, it doesn't guarantee that you're really following. I mean, you have a flow here, right? Essentially,
yeah.
Fiber gives you a flow, but
yeah.
that doesn't have to be a geodesic flow. I think there is some biological hypothesis which is made here, kind of.
What do you mean by it doesn't have to be a geodesic flow in that case? If we're just saying that.
Well, if you start in the direction of it's the first eigenvector. And so you have two options. You can follow the first eigenvector of the tensor all the time and integrate that through.
Yes.
But is it true that this would be the same as computing the geodesics?
If the tensor are perfectly anisotropic, yeah.
I guess so, but if not,
that's actually one of the things that we think is good, is that you can use the orthogonal information of the major eigenvectors. So let's say you have a region with a fanning or with crossing, you're going to have a spherical or planar or whatever pancake shaped tensor, and you can still propagate through this region using the, you know, the fact that it's not, if you do streamlined tractography, you're going to stop there because the FA is very low and you don't have any reliable information. But here you can integrate it when you actually compute the geodesic function, and that's kind of a way to have a, I mean, it's kind of a global way to look at it, I guess. That's, but I don't know if, I mean, is, does that make sense to you? I don't understand what.
There's still a huge bigger length behind that because the tensor is not degenerate. And so there is some idea that you take short. I mean, when you read that, you take the shortest.
So you're concerned about
the Euclidean space, essentially. And that's the biological hypothesis.
Yes. But so what you're saying is that you can get a lot of false positive connections because the curve.
Yeah, you may jump maybe.
Oh, yeah.
When you get to a maybe.
But then that's the point of the connectivity index that we have, which is trying to look at every single path. Anyway, most of the paths that we compute are not correct because we basically connect one point to everything. And then with the connectivity index, we can discard a lot of them, and only the ones that are the most reliable are kept. So it's true that you have a lot of connections that probably do what you're saying. And then we just try to discard the ones that are not relevant, but maybe we can continue after. I'm going to show one application of how we can combine DTI and fMRI using the technique that I just showed. So the problem here was to look at the anatomical connection in the human striatum, because we know that it can be parceled by DTI. And there are different circuits that are involved in distinct behavior or function, like the preparation of motion, of movement, learning, or the planning of a motion. So what we did with Stéphane Leraissy, who did the whole fMRI part, was to look at the connectivity pattern of two regions of the striatum. The first one is the anterior compartment of the striatum, which is an associative region, which is known to be implicated in the movement planning and selection decision, and the posterior part of the striatum is known to be involved in the storage of skills. And so the task here for I think 13 subjects was to learn a finger tapping experiment, which was non-trivial, and they had to practice at home. And what Stéphane showed was that over the course of 4 weeks, there was a decrease of the activation in the posterior, I think, in the anterodorsal putamen, so which is the region which is the associative region, so the region dedicated to the planning, and an increase
of the fMRI signal in the anterior posterior ventral putamen, which is the region dedicated to the storage of motor skills. And then what we did was to start from those functional areas and do tractography. So you have the day one activation, the day 28 activation. We started from those regions, did tractography, and tried to look at the probability of connection between these two guys with the motor cortex. And it turns out that before, the probability, the connection with the highest probability were in the pre-SMA, so the anterior part of the motor cortex. And afterwards, after the 4 weeks, the connection with the highest connectivity index were more in the sensory motor cortex and posterior SMA, which was, of course, that was the hypothesis, and it was nice that we could actually show it. And we did it on 13 subjects. So this is one subject before learning and after learning. So you can see the shift from the anterior to the posterior region of the motor cortex. Then we normalized the map and looked at the average normalized individual maps, and we could show that there was a significant shift in the highest connectivity for the connections between the two compartments of the putamen. And those are the two fiber bundles. So that's before, so with the anterior dorsal, and then after with the posterior ventral part of the putamen. Do I still have like 5 minutes, or should I stop here? Okay, great. So I still have two parts that I wanted to talk about. So the segmentation and then the application of the machine learning technique that Guillermo Sapiro talked about on Monday. So this first part is how do we actually try to segment fiber bundles at once without doing tractography, so by a surface evolution technique. So the question is how can we recover such a bundle? The idea behind that is simply that we can model the distribution of diffusion tensors with the statistics that I've described a couple of slides ago. And then we can evolve a 3D surface by maximizing the likelihood of the partition. So the framework behind that is pretty simple. It's just we define an evolving surface, which is implicitly represented here by Psi, where the distance is positive in the outside region, negative inside, and zero on the boundary. So that's just the implicit representation of the surface. And then a structure of interest is extracted by minimizing this energy, where we try to maximize the likelihood of the probability of a given tensor to be inside the region. So given a mean tensor and a covariance metric tensor describing the distribution of the tensors inside the region, the same thing for the outside. And then we have also some a smoothness constraint on the surface. And that's just a boundary detection term to try to avoid crossings between different regions with the high gradients between the tensors. The energy comes from the fact that the tensors are independently distributed. So you can write the probability of a given tensors given a segmentation like that. So it's the product of the probability to be in region one, times the probability to be in region 2, times the probability to be in the on the boundary. And the probability to be on the boundary is given by this expression. And at the end, when you write the other Lagrange equation of your energy, it just boils down to that, and that gives you the speed of evolution of your surface along its normal. So those guys here, sigma 1, lambda 1, and 2, are the statistics that I described a few slides ago, so the mean and the covariance matrix that we can use to evolve the surface. If you do it in such a simple example, you don't see the movies? That's weird. It's weird because there is one of them that already
saw. May not have been.
I'm sorry?
Oh, okay. I just wonder if I got loaded in properly.
Really?
That's strange. Huh, okay. No. All right, well, there's a couple of movies that we're not going to be able to see here. Anyways, I think I have a couple of static images. So the point here was to show that on this more complicated example where you have high variability of the tensors, only the Riemannian metric was able to, this is an helix, so was able to recover the complete helix. So the Euclidean metric and the J-divergence metric was actually, were actually only able to get portions of the helix. Here that was to show, but then I have static images, so that's cool. That was to show you that the Riemannian metric actually does a better job for the segmentation of the genu of the corpusculum, the full corpusculum. If I can get to the next slide, okay. So that's the Euclidean metric. As you can see, it's pretty bad in the genu area. The J-divergence is a little bit of a better job, and the Riemannian metric actually captures much more details of the genu of the splenium. Sorry, the splenium of the corpusculum. This is a comparison where you can see the three different metric used to do the segmentation, and the Riemannian one goes further. That was a cortical spinal tract. It's just a movie, so we're not going to be able to see it. We applied a biological phantom that I already described from Campbell et al. At McGill to show the difference between the three metric. I have a static image after that, but I think the movies are trying to run.
But it is.
Okay, so that was just to compare. You have in red the Euclidean, the J-divergence, and the geodesic in blue, and especially in the region of the where the tensors are very close to each other, only the blue, I think, is able to make the distinction between the different bundles. And this can be easily extended to Hardy, where instead of segmenting, or instead of using the tensors, what Maxime Decoteau has done was to do statistics on the spherical harmonic coefficient of, so the spherical harmonic expansion of the ODFs. And you can actually show that in practice, if you do manual segmentation of the corpus callosum, they follow a Gaussian distribution. So those are all the spherical harmonics coefficients at different orders, and they are pretty much Gaussian-like. So it makes sense to use a Gaussian distribution for the spherical harmonics coefficient. And so the metric is simply for two ODFs, psi and psi prime, they're simply the L2 norm of the difference between the spherical harmonic coefficients. And that's a shame because I have two movies also. But so on the synthetic examples, you can see that if you use the DTI segmentation, it will stop in the region of the crossing because the DTI is just simply not enough to describe the crossing that occurs here. Although the Hardy segmentation completely goes through and get the whole shape, that's just another initialization, and you can see that the DTI gets stuck in the crossing area. No movies, sorry about that. Just 2 or 3 minutes to wrap things up with the result of the application of the complexity, the machine learning techniques that Guillermo Sapiro described on Monday. Well, the point here is to look at point clouds and try to estimate the local density and local dimension of these point clouds. So here, if you take that, you would like to say, okay, I have one point cloud here, the kind of a helix, and I have two others here because they have different densities. So the contribution of their work was to use a translated Poisson model to account for noise, to do local estimation and local estimation of density and dimension, and use that in a clustering algorithm to differentiate different point clouds within the global point clouds. And here the points are simply the spherical harmonic representation of the ODFs. So we have a point cloud in R15
if we are using fourth order spherical harmonics, or R28 if we are using sixth order, and that's just another synthetic example. So what we've done here was to use all the points on the grid without using at all the spatial information, and try to see if by using the density and the dimension information, we could find different compartments in the brain, using just that clustering algorithm. And let me zoom in. So using the raw Hardy signal, you can see that we get like the white matter, the cortex, the more anisotropic regions and very anisotropic region of the corpus callosum, but it's pretty rough. Then if you go to fourth order ODFs, it's a little bit better, and you can see that you have especially the very high anisotropic region in the genu of the corpus callosum that are labeled here in yellow, and then you have other anisotropic region, and then less anisotropic region in light blue, and then the more complex fibers, the more complex voxels with crossings in purple, and then everything else in green. I think I have a close-up of that. That was to show the evolution of the dimension, which is decreasing as you go toward very anisotropic region, where here, for instance, you have about 2.5, which kind of makes sense, because in this region, all that matters is basically the direction, and you can just use two angles to encode this direction. So it kind of physically makes sense, I guess, to have this kind of dimension. And so if you look at the close up in the genu of the corpus callosum that you can see here, with the different labels that are superimposed here, you can see that as you go from the more diverging part of the genu, the corpus callosum, towards the interhemispheric plane, M, which is the dimension, decreases and goes down to 2, which is what I just showed. So this is just to acknowledge the people that I've been working on and that contributed to all the slides and all those all the slides. And if you have any question, I'd be happy to answer it.
Thanks, Christoph, for a great lecture. I think we'd all agree that very few people can give a lecture at that high level, and we'll definitely have Christoph back to give a two-hour lecture. Are there any questions? There's maybe just 2 or 3 minutes if you have any questions. Yes.
So I also have some problems to understand the anatomical basis, which is at the base of the choice that you made about the shortest path.
Right.
Because when I was listening to your lecture, I was thinking about some examples in the brain where this could cause some real problems. Because many times I see corpus callosum, that's fine, but there are some particular fibers which can create problems when you just choose the shortest path. If you think about, for instance, what happens in the optic radiation, what if one tries to detect Myers loop, or what if one tries to detect new fibers, which are the extension of the Eukaryotic fluid and fascicle? Some of these situations may cause problems if you just look at the shortest path, because you prevent yourself from finding those regions in which actually the solution found by the brain is not the shortest one, so to say. There are also problems, there are also some other cases where if you try to look at connections between superior temporal and inferior frontal regions, you maybe cannot find a connection that passes through the parietal lobe.
Right, no, that's true. No, yeah.
It's, I think for some questions it can be really useful, but mm-hmm. in some other cases it's a really big assumption from the anatomical.
Right, what do you mean by the brain doesn't make this the same assumption as shortest path?
No, in the sense that to assume that what happens in the brain is that the connection between two voxels, between two parts of the brain, is always the shortest one that can be calculated on the basis of diffusion weighted data,
mm-hmm.
it cannot always be true. I wonder what happens, for instance, if you try to detect the connection between the lateral geniculate body and the V1. What
mm-hmm.
happens if you can find actually the Myers loop, if you can delineate it in a clear way, or whether
yeah,
you can find
I can show you we have some stuff like that. Yeah, we looked at the connection between the visual areas
and like the LGN, and NMTD1, and so on. So I have some result like that to show you, and it kind of worked actually.
Okay.
So then, I don't know why it worked if you're right.
Sorry?
I don't know why it worked if you're right, but I mean, we have. I can show you. We can discuss that. Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's.
I think your point's still taken. If there were known cases where you had to override the shortest path,
yes,
for the Bayesian prior and other trends. So, are there any other questions?
Maybe. Yes.
Maybe a short one. So, what do you mean by connectivity index? Is it just the fact that you find the streamline, or do you have somehow a strength of diffusion?
We have.
What is the measure?
Right. So there have been quite a few measures that have been proposed, like what you said, the agreement of the tangent of the curve with the major eigenvector. What we have in the thing that I've skipped, which is the optimal control formulation, you can actually, at the end, get the so-called optimal dynamics, which is when you try to minimize a function, the optimal path, I mean, the optimal direction to follow, and the norm of this gradient, if it's large, is because you actually want to go fast. So it's kind of, it's similar to the major eigenvector, but you get it from the optimal dynamic formulation, and if you integrate that, so if you integrate the norm of these dynamics, it gives you the connectivity map that I showed. So it's kind of a control formulation of the problem. It's one among a lot, but that's what we used, and it was all right. Yeah.
Other questions?
Yeah.
So if you have the diffusion matrix, if you were inverted, you're using that for the geodesic distance, right?
Yeah.
So the inverted D also gives you the Gaussian probability density function.
I'm sorry?
D inverse.
Yeah.
Is not only a geodesic distance, but it also defines your Gaussian PDF.
Right, yeah. Why don't we use what? Some
At every voxel, the inverse gives you a geodesic measure.
Right.
But it also gives you a PDF.
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, can you compare between using a PDF there instead of a geodesic distance?
Means taking the exponential,
like. Yeah. Well, probably, but I don't know what it means then. I mean, it gives what?
The EAP,
the EAP, yeah. Right, no, that's true, but I mean, I don't. Right, yeah, I mean, in a sense, I mean, it's what you do when you do, for instance, stochastic tractography, where you try to use, you sample a PDF on the sphere, and then you're gonna take sample direction from that, so you could, that's what you're saying, right? The second point.
So, I mean, like, which would be better, to use a geodesic measure or to use the PDF?
I'm not sure I get your point. What we do here is that, is what you're saying. We're looking at the shortest physical distance using the diffusion tensor, not the distance between tensors. I mean, is your point about tractography here?
Right.
Okay. Because the distance between tensors doesn't have anything to do here with tractography.
I think he's just agreeing. You can induce a measure based on your distances, and then you could probabilistically interpret the path that you, of course, know.
Okay.
So in the same way, take a path through a trellis, like a Markov model. Take a path of a sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And
these things are intimately tied together, and you, of course, know that.
Okay.
Just
yeah.
Making that comment.
Yeah.
No, I think not thinking about it. I think it's the same, in fact, because
it is.
If you take a given trajectory and you look at the radio of a tumor of that, probability of a tumor of that, I think the first order approximation is the exponential of the.
Oh, okay.
Tumor.
So
yeah.
That's the same.
Yeah.
Do you say basically that the same under context?
Yeah. I think you can interpret these two approaches in a unified way, and you can associate a probability, of course. This measure is sitting on 50 length, 55 length, 60. I mean, you have to be careful here, right? Because you're not looking at only 50 length tracks. You're looking at all tracks that can generate, so they're all different lengths. So, in language, this comes up, right? You have to look at the unions of all numbers of sentences of different lengths, and you have to figure out how you want to interpret that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very natural interpretation of the probability of a path, and then the energy of a path.
Right.
On that note, let's drink coffee for 10 minutes and come back again. Thank Christoph.